I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Welcome back. My guest today is someone I consider an important teacher in my life, Stephen Jenkinson. Steve is a cultural activist. He is a farmer. He is a sculptor. He is a philosopher in many, many ways, but he is also an author of many, many books, including some that are my favorites: Die Wise, Money, and The Desires of the Soul. A Generation's Worth, his book during the pandemic. And I think there is one more, but I'm not informed of it, that came later after that. But he basically sort of presents life as it really is. And because of many, many years of working with the dying, he attempts to anchor us in the reality of where we are. And there isn't a time where we need this more. So I'm going to tell you, being aware of Stephen's work, this might not appear to be a very cheerful conversation because our world is going to be facing challenges as we progress into the next decade. But the truth is, also, if you understand Stephen's work and if you understand my approach to holding on to the truth and engaging with it, I expect to have one of the most cheerful conversations about the reality of where we are today and how we can deal with it, engage with it, almost like a video gamer engages in a challenging video game. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a very long time. I've just arrived from Rio de Janeiro and I'm so jet-lagged. But I couldn't ask to delay it. I couldn't ask to move it because this definitely is an important moment for me, a moment where I meet one of my heroes, Stephen Jenkinson. Hello, Stephen, always, always so elegantly dressed.
Well, it's very kind of you to notice. I think you're exaggerating, but I'll take it.
I never say that, but when I was younger, I'm guessing you might be a year or two older than I am. And so I always told myself that when I reach my 60s, my retirement plan would be to wake up every morning and wear a full, beautiful suit and walk slowly to a place that is familiar to me where I have a cup of coffee and ponder life. And as I study your work and look at your videos, you seem to be doing exactly that, aren't you?
It's important in that... fantasy to get paid somewhere in there too.
I didn't think about that bit.
You know what they say is trust in God and tie up your camel, no?
Exactly. Yeah, I wrote that in one of my books, actually. The idea, however, is that as a young man, I learned to never negotiate in my dreams. You know, life will negotiate enough with me. So, you know, when I had a chance to dream, I would simply say, and money would pour in from the ceiling. Why not? You know, that's not a bad place to be.
Okay. Well, listen, if that happens, you call me, I'll come to where you are.
Yeah, then I would have figured something out.
Clearly.
Yes. I actually want to ask you about that lifestyle that I constantly see you when you're teaching. You're out in nature. You seem to be in a very contemplative mode. Your school, the Orphan Wisdom School, is not in the middle of the noisy life that we live in. And I believe that you made that move back in 2010, or has that always been the way you lived, you know, a little bit further from all the madness, if you want?
Well, probably before the move to the country, I made the move somewhere inside me to withdraw a little bit from the fracas. I don't remember a particular time that I did so, but probably my own inclinations are towards a kind of combination of solitude and solemnity. And then I just had to find a circumstance where I could articulate that and have it available. And ultimately that turned into farming, but not initially, because I wasn't born to farming. So I had to outgrow all my immature understanding of what it would be. And, you know, of course I imagined a kind of contemplative dream of sorts, and this is not true at all. Farming is highly engaged, but whereas you could say the life of a monk, or a dervish perhaps, is a life that's trying to separate itself from the world and imposes upon itself a high degree of rigor in its discipline to compensate for the goneness of the world. In the case of farming, instead of the vows that you make to God, for example, you have the weather. And the weather is your local God. And the weather asks things of you, does things to you. But mostly what it does is it takes your decision-making and gives it a very small place on the side. Oh. And mostly what you're doing is trying to respond. So that circumstance changes your notion of self-determination. And it makes you something closer to a kind of servant rather than a kind of master.
That's so beautiful. If you would allow me, I know we're in a podcast and there are tens of thousands of people that will be listening to this, but this is a topic that's very, 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 I've been preoccupied with this for quite some time. You use the word dervish, and perhaps I don't feel fully like a monk. I feel more like a wandering dervish, if you want. And it's been knocking at my heart now for several years. I've attempted many times to retreat 40 days at a time. But I have to say openly, I dream of a life where I'm more controlled by nature than I am controlled by civilization, if you want. And yet I feel a duty to show up. Those incredible conversations I have on this podcast seem to be making a difference to some people. So did you manage to find the balance between what you're supposed to do in life, between making money, as you mentioned at the beginning, and between that idea of I need serenity, I need solitude, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning?
Yeah. I don't think balance would be the right word. I think a kind of useful and devout compromise is a better understanding of it.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think the notion of balance puts you in a kind of masterful position. That's the sound of it to me, that you kind of negotiate all the contending circumstances and somehow you find this place where it's neither yin nor yang, something like this. But I think certainly the life of farming is not the life of mastery. It's the life of ongoing compromise. And for every action that you undertake, it's preceded by hours and hours of inaction, apparent inaction, which is the act of, we call it at home, we call it watching the farm channel.
Yes.
And this is where you're taking dictation from. You know, what you're doing is watching what you thought you knew again and discovering you didn't quite know it. Whether it's the behavior of animals, whether it's their interaction with the weather, whether it's, of course, the gross changes in dominant weather patterns that are happening now, where your old understanding of there's certain weather patterns or seasonal realities that you could count on, that's all gone, basically. I mean, I shouldn't say it's all gone, but I think it's going.
Clear.
And yeah, clearly so. So all of this is to say then, that a farmer's job, I don't think, is to achieve balance. Not really. The farmer's job is to compromise and ultimately to lose in the struggle, quote unquote, against nature. Because that's what farming is. Farming mostly is fighting with the circumstances, seeing if you can find a way to survive. I know it's not a popular understanding, city people in particular favor the notion that farmers are out there, you know, being at one with the universe and loving the weeds and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But this is not true at all. It's an immense struggle. And the more debt you have, and the more you are in the pocket of the big agricultural conglomerates and suppliers and so on, the more compromises you make. So instead of making spiritual compromise with the world, wherein you are supposed to lose as a human being, you instead make these terrible moral compromises with necessity and with indebtedness and so on. And I don't think most human beings can survive that degree of moral compromise. And this is why I think the world over, you know, fewer and fewer farmers appear in the young generation. And everywhere you go where the big agribusiness prevails, you have an immensely high, dangerous rate of suicide amongst farmers.
That's very true.
These things are all quite relevant to each other, you know.
Yeah. I want to visit some of your work, which I have to say is plenty. If we were to cover all of your books, it would take us 4.5 days to just skim the surface, honestly. But do you believe that this struggle is just part of the human experience? That if you're in the city, you're struggling with all of the challenges of being amongst humans with so many contradicting objectives and targets and agendas. And if you're out there, you're struggling with nature and the morality of what you need to do to fit in a little bit with that other world. Is there any place where there isn't that struggle?
Well, I think the formula that you've described has a certain presumption, and it's that the same person, whether in the city or in the country, brings the same repertoire, the same degree of prejudice, the same unexamined sense of being on the losing end of life kind of feeling. So therefore, struggle becomes the order of the day, and it's just how you articulate the struggle from one context to the next. But the real possibility exists that from time to time, there are people who understand the realities that we're describing differently than conditions of struggle. And so when I said earlier that one of our responsibilities as human beings is to fail, what I mean is if you look at what human beings do to the world as a consequence of their numerical and technological success, you'd rightly come to the conclusion that the more humans are defeated, the better it is for humans.
Oh, wow.
You see, so if you can understand that, it's a big challenge to live it out, of course. But as an understanding of a principle, it's possible that you could bring that understanding into a kind of life where, in addition to the struggle, you have a sense of gratitude, of thanksgiving. And those two things together, they moderate the intensity of what we're describing here. I think they do. And they give you a chance to reflect and to be especially grateful for things that don't benefit you directly, but they're in the world, and so they have some necessity. And if your gratitude goes there, then your self-interest is not the boss. Your concern for the greater world is the boss. And gratitude is your way of articulating that sense of responsibility to the world. And that's why I said shorthandedly, it's better for all things concerned if humans are defeated in their sense of grandiosity and mastery and dominion.
So wise, I have to admit, those words will stay with me forever. The idea, perhaps as I negotiate in my mind now, of at least succeeding sufficiently but not crossing the line. And it seems to me that life is now defeating us in a very interesting way, as you mentioned. Climate change, for example, it's basically life saying, look, you guys, honestly, I appreciate very much all of the innovation, but hey, I still have the power here. I'm going to change things a little for you so that you fail a little more or be defeated a little more. It's quite eye-opening that you see it this way.
Another element that's important to introduce, and I learned this from working with dying people so often, is that for grown-ups in the real world, there is such a thing as too late. And I would not be surprised to discover or to have it confirmed over the next decade that we are in many respects already in the time of too late. That the notion of personal conservation and recycling, and I mean, these are nominally important things. But honestly, as I said to a guy here in the village the other day, recycling your personal plastic that comes out of your house is basically like changing your socks. It has that degree of consequence in the wider world. I'm not saying don't do it. I do it myself. But let's just not delude ourselves to thinking that this is all we have to do. And if enough of us recycle our plastic, then the climate will readjust itself and the dolphins will be swimming in the canals of Venice. I don't think so.
I don't either. But then how do we respond to that, Steve? I mean, in many ways, my work also looks at artificial intelligence and where artificial intelligence is going. It's looking at the current geopolitical environment and how the world is heating up, you know, in terms of power struggles, the economic struggles, and so on. And, you know, for many of us, I think we're on the receiving end of this because the maximum we can do is like changing our socks. So how do you find peace and calm in a world where it seems that we're approaching a point where it's going to become a little tougher?
Yeah, I don't think we're approaching a point. I think we're there.
I'm trying to be a little kinder to the ears of my listeners.
Yeah. You know, again, this is a terminology that I think I learned when I was working with dying people. Dying people would refer to their dying in the future tense constantly. When I die. Or sometimes if I die. But never I'm dying. But you see, they were all dying. Not in some nominal Buddhist sense of the term that everybody's dying all the time, which is clearly not true. But they were actually metabolically dying, and they were employing their dying time to resist the realities of dying. And that seems to be a fairly good metaphor for modernity, that we are in some sense in a period where the onset of ruination is already occurring. And yet we talk about waiting to see and hypothetical questions like, how do we do this and do that? And I think we're better served and the world is better served if we just change the tense of all of these ruminations and start saying, how have we done thus and so? Because if you can faithfully witness to how things have come to be as they are, then the notion about what does one do in the face of this storm becomes more available, because it's a response to something, not a kind of generic reactivity. It's a particular kind of, as we'd say in English, response ability. Yeah. Mm. So for me, I'm not a fan of hope. I don't find that there's any obligation necessarily among grown-ups, sentient grown-ups, to pat each other on the shoulder and reassure each other, and that if we just do this, and if we find some equanimity, and if we just change our socks, and if enough people change their socks all at once, well, you know, the globe will tip. And, you know, this is not how it happened, and it's not how it's going to happen either. The truth of the matter is, it seems. You're familiar with the English poet W.H. Auden?
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So he has a wondrous but kind of ruinous observation he's made about modernity. He said, it seems to me that we would rather be defeated than be persuaded.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of circumstance now, geopolitically, socioeconomically, where the powers that be and the great sort of middle class, if you will, are there with their arms folded playing, let's see what happens. But doing that is the answer to the question, what happens? This is what happens now. Waiting to see if it's really that bad. Waiting to see if people like me are not just exaggerating or worse, and that we're secretly hopeless and we're just vectoring our hopelessness, you know, from podcast to podcast, which I'm not hopeless at all. I'm free of the notion of hope. which is to say, you know, the last time I checked it out thoroughly, hope is a very much a future tense circumstance. That's where it actually operationalizes in the future. But it has immense consequence for the present. But for example, hope is completely not required to mobilize on behalf of a better day. No.
I agree.
I think one of the things we're doing right now is mobilizing, you and I at this very moment, mobilizing on behalf of a better day. I'm not saying we're being very successful or very effective, but at least in intention, this is what we're doing. But look what's not necessary. You and I don't have to hope we're sitting here talking to be able to sit here and talk. Hope is completely not required to engage the dilemmas that we're beginning to talk about now. If you require hope, you're importing it from elsewhere. Yeah. So hope is always a compromise of the present moment. Nobody hopes for the way it is. We hope for the way it isn't. Okay, so my orientation to life is to do everything I can to inhabit the way it is.
That's so beautiful. So I have to say, as I hear you talking and the likening of this to working with the dying, it almost seems like a disservice to the dying to tell them, oh, hold on, you know, you're going to get better.
It's not almost a disservice. It's malpractice.
Oh, that's so eye-opening. And what you're basically saying is that we're all dying sooner or later, right? It seems that the planet, as we have treated it, is sort of responding in a bit of a I'm sick way, and that the answer is found in here and now. The answer is not found in what will happen in 10, 20 years' time. The answer is what's happening right now.
The answer, I think, is found in the capacity to formulate increasingly more responsible questions.
Elaborate on that, Steve.
Sure. Generally speaking, you and I know we come from a kind of education, a formal education or informal one, where the notion is that you use questions to achieve better and better answers. And as soon as you achieve a better answer, then the old question is dispensed with and no longer necessary. And you use the question the way you use a tin can. Once you've got the contents of the can, you just throw away the can. But I'm suggesting to you that a better question is that thing you're looking for. A better question serves the circumstance. You know, good answers are a dime a dozen. Clever answers, ironic answers, dismissive answers. There's millions of them. But a good question, by definition, survives the answers that you bring to it. It's still there, like those stars in the night sky, still there, still wondering, unconquered, unvanquished, and unblinking. That third one, it might be the most important, unblinking in the sense of not wavering. Yes, obviously informed of the desperate circumstances that I think we're entering into, but not dissuaded by those circumstances. That's what a better question is. It's not a better mousetrap, as they say in colloquial English. It's a better question. And a better question is a sign that you remain engaged. But trying to cancel out the questions with better answers is a sign, to me, more often than not, of people trying to get out from under life or get out from under the oncomingness of the likely near future and things like that.
So what's our better question as we speak?
Not what do we do? What do we do now? What are we doing now? This is observable. It's not hypothetical. And Auden's observation is sadly accurate. It's clear that contemporary modernist people, really across the world, are more inclined to be persuaded by defeat than persuaded by persuasion. Because persuasion indicates somehow that you're surrendering. But defeat somehow suggests in a vague and vain heroic way that you haven't succumbed yet, that you can still struggle out from underneath something, that you can still somehow, you know, prevail. And like I said off the top, the more humans are heroic and prevail, the more ruin follows the example. So this is why I'm suggesting that a line of inquiry that serves our ability to be defeated, hopefully with a little grace and something like elegance, is the order of the day. It's not an affection. It's not what color of tie you wear. It's your willingness to carry yourself in the world as if your mastery is an accident that you've grown to overcome.
That is incredible. I mean, so I've been looking forward to our conversation for quite some time. I was in Rio de Janeiro a couple of days ago, and I just landed, so I'm completely jet-lagged. And as I was getting on the flight, I was thinking, who am I going to be speaking to as I land in Dubai? And maybe if I can reschedule it. And it turns out that it was our appointment. So I was like, no, we're not rescheduling this. Because I think your perception of what we have today, since your very early work, to be honest, Stephen, is I think what humanity is missing in the equation of trying to deal with our calamities, if I may use the word. I want to touch on two of your books, one very, very, very early and one more recent, to cover this topic. I want to touch on all of your books, but maybe we meet several times if your time allows. So in your very first book, Money and the Desires of the Soul, I think a lot of what we go through in life today is because of that hunger for money. And your conversation of in the book about the idea that we sort of like the spiritual ones would say, oh, no, I don't need that. I don't, you know, I give that up. I'm not interested in this. Is sort of, again, hiding our heads in the sand, basically, because, you know, the soul has to merge with that progress that made money part of our life somehow. Can I ask you openly, what do you define as the desires of the soul? And what should our souls desire at times of confusion that we're coming to?
Well, I mean, because we use the word soul here, and in contemporary English, this topography is very uncertain, and we're not very articulate in contemporary English about the nuances that constitute, quote, soul. So I prefer to understand soul as a verb rather than a noun, and understand it as a way of making your way rather than as you or some possession that you have, this kind of particularly special inner part of you that you could call the soul. So you imagine it as a souling then. They turn into a verb. How does the soul go about its work then? Might be a question to ask. And this is why I wrote a book called Money and the Soul's Desires, to suggest that money, it doesn't say money or the soul's desires, as if there's some kind of dichotomy and you have to decide between them. And once you've decided on behalf of the soul, then you have no more money trouble or whatever it is. The soul has an obligation in its work to engage the world. Engage doesn't mean defeat. It doesn't mean manage. It doesn't even mean survive. It means to join in some fashion without disappearance, to engage purposefully over time, not in one fitful moment of alleged insight, but ongoingly to plant the insight, you know, for the sake of a better day. So I think there's nothing particularly elevated about soulfulness. Soul has, its work is in the alley, not in the celestial spheres. It's out, you know, behind the tavern. I mean, this is one of the things that makes Rumi and Hafez so lovable, is their understanding that the soul belongs in the world, and that the trouble is not the soul's, the trouble is ours. You may be familiar with this one. I'll see if I can remember how it goes, or at least how it begins. He says, all day long I think about it, and that at night I can't help it. I say it. Who am I? And what am I supposed to be doing? And I have no idea if I could only break out of this prison for drunks. The point that Rumi's pursuing there is that the sense of not quite belonging to the world, which I would suggest to you is the soul's problem, not the world's problem. In other words, the world is a perfectly good place for the soul. But if the soul thinks otherwise, then the soul is not working very assiduously. So I think the soul is part of creation, not some kind of hovering being that doesn't really belong in creation, but accidentally finds itself here and, you know, has to make do.
Perhaps, as you once said, it's the need, it's what the soul needs, is to be engaged in this world. Hovering on top of it doesn't really deliver to the soul what the soul actually
requires. You could say the soul needs the world.
Yeah.
But it's not clear that the world really needs the human soul, not really. I mean, no more than the world needs more humans.
Correct. I mean, in an interesting way, it's the soul's journey through the world that is perhaps the only way to answer that question by Rumi, which is, who am I and why am I here?
Yeah, what am I supposed to be doing?
What am I supposed to do here?
I'm like a bird from some other aviary, he says. The day's coming when I'll fly off, but until then, who speaks with my mouth? Who sees with my eye? And what is the soul? And it's an amazing sort of rumination that allows for the real possibility of genuine confusion in the soul, a genuine sense of alienation that itself doesn't really belong. I'll put it differently. Our feeling that we don't really belong here doesn't really belong here.
Beautiful. Indeed. Which once again is a very, very eye-opening observation around what needs to be done here. I think your latest book, which I have to admit, you choose titles that are almost exactly what we don't want to hear, right? It's like, okay, you know, I think a lot of us, including myself, but a lot of, you know, many people want to escape the reality of what's happening around us. And your latest book is Spirit Work While the Crisis Reigns, right? And I think that should definitely be my next question. So the spirit belongs here, the soul belongs here as the crisis is building around us. In a very interesting way, I would say, there's always been some kind of a crisis, right? Whether it's climate change approaching us or, you know, the crisis might have been, I'm sort of stuck in traffic when I don't want to be stuck in traffic or some silly.
Yes. Yeah, it's same magnitude, but I know what you mean. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, some of us will choose to look at whatever state our life is in, and then take whatever is wrong and consider that the crisis, right? So what is the spirit work in the time where crisis reigns?
Okay. Actually, thank you for mentioning it. It's actually the second last book that you're referring to.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It is.
Did you have another one? This was 2021.
Yeah, the second last book was called A Generation's Worth, Spirit Work While the Crisis Reigns. Mm-hmm. And that basically was a book that took form during the course of the pandemic.
Okay.
The most recent book is called Reckoning.
Oh, I did not hear of that. What's wrong with me? I need this. I need it badly. Reckoning. Okay. I think that describes the whole whole approach.
So anyway, so apropos of the question that you've asked, though, the axis here of the question, or the challenge in the question, is the meaning of crisis. Crisis doesn't mean calamity. Etymologically, the word crisis means something like this. So there is a kind of inadvertent or unintentional crossroads that you find yourself at. And in moments like that, whereas once upon a time you imagined you had many possibilities to choose from, at the time of a crisis, you only have a few, but there's still choices to be made. And the moment of choosing is upon you, and you will voluntarily or otherwise choose. That's what a crisis is.
Mm.
So in and of itself, it doesn't mean that something's terribly wrong. It just means you don't have a lot of room to negotiate anymore. And that's why we get that secondary sense of crisis, of some terrible thing looming and the sky falling and all these kinds of things. It's not really what it means. So with that from that point of view, spirit work while the crisis reigns. The crisis nominally was the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. But much more importantly, it was our increasing reactivities to the pandemic, not the pandemic per se.
Correct.
Or you could say what it turned out to be is that 9/10 of the pandemic was our reactivity to it, and 1/10 was the virus.
Correct. Such and a the reactivity, way to describe it.
The reactivity, for, I mean, I shouldn't speak with such great authority about all kinds of places in the world, but from what I've seen and from what comes to me by virtue of talks like this with other people from all over the place, is the sense that we're just beginning to see the kind of, I'm going to use it, the hell flower of the pandemic blossoming. We're only beginning to see it now. And a lot of it is mobilizing in the so-called social justice world. You know, the notion of personal truth is the only kind of truth that's reliable. It's the only kind of truth that there is. The kind of extraordinary war upon tradition and upon received wisdom. And I could go on, but the suggestion I made with the subtitle is the work of the spirit in a time of crisis is the work of engagement and direct action. It's not the work of withdrawal. Or if there's withdrawal necessary, it's temporary, and it should be redeeming, not seeking after solace, but an act of redemption as well. Well, the souls are infinite. I could keep saying so at the end of a sentence, but the thing that mobilized me was the vision that we are not anywhere near at the conclusion of an episode. You know, globally, I'm sure that it makes no sense to speak globally, because look out your window and you can't see the globe. You can't find it. You can't find everything. So ultimately, you know, are we not blind men touching various parts of the elephant, trying to make grand statements about what it is? But it doesn't prevent us from guessing or from being wonderstruck, or especially from being full of awe. I'm writing a book right now here. I'm in Tuscany in Italy. I have to teach this book next week, so I better finish it or come close. And the book is really an attempt to translate awful to awe. And it seems to me, and I'm doing so by investigating basic culture and agriculture and where they touch and where they conflict. And awe seems to me to be the soul's work to restore the dignity of awe and the necessity of, even in a world that fancies itself in so many ways on the other side of God, if you know what I mean by this.
What's the other side of God?
The other side of God is we don't need a God anymore, because we're doing, you know, we've somehow improved our materialism such that God, as the old placeholder for things we didn't know, we know more and more things all the time, so there's less and less God available to us.
Yeah, predicted by most spiritual teachings that eventually as humans get to believe that they are now in control of the earth and everything in it, the need for God doesn't exist anymore. And the reality, of course, is that they get awakened, if you want, in those predictions by the fact that they were never in control at all.
The other reality, too, being that it is certainly the Western point of view to talk for over and over again about whether or not we need God. Yeah. But rare is the human who's willing to offer the considerable possibility that the need might be reciprocal.
Correct.
And there might be a thing, a reality called God's need of us. Not commandments, you know, not demands, needs. Imagine that the work of God in some strange way requires the presence of the humane amongst the humans.
How profound. I have to ask you this. I'm really sorry. But you know, I'm a computer scientist at heart, and you know what I can see in terms of having a drop of the divine in each and every one of us is probably a form of distributed agents, if you want, that are out there in this video game-like environment to purify and test and learn and assess information and basically return to the source with more knowledge, if you want, or more, I don't know, knowledge is the wrong word, but more insight, more enlightenment, which is a very rejected view by most of the religious establishment because God is almighty and is beyond becoming more, if you want. But it's interesting because we are a drop of God in a spiritual sense and we are supposed to become more. But the question in my mind is, why does this matter at all? If the divine is a non-physical entity, if my spirit is a non-physical entity, and this entire physical world that engages us, and that you so rightly said the spirit work is to engage in, why does it matter? Sometimes the easiest way to win the video game is to just switch off the Xbox.
Oh, that's the only way to win, I think.
That's not, you and I should not be speaking in public, I think. in front of tens of thousands of people, it's a bit of a gloomy view unless you really, really deeply understand the reality of who we are. It's not gloomy at all.
It's not gloomy at all. It employs gloom, mm-hmm. but it doesn't inhabit gloom. We're not ignoring the gloom.
Yes, that's the whole point.
But for the purposes of what we're talking about, we're not overly impressed by the gloom either.
Exactly.
Okay, so in response to your question then, so I was lucky enough to have a school in the pre-pandemic days. It was called the Orphan Wisdom School.
Yes.
It still exists as an idea. And we'll see if the students are willing to come back. But anyway, times have changed. But in the school curriculum, the third book I teach in the sequence is the Epic of Gilgamesh, which comes from an area of the world close to where you're sitting now, certainly closer than where I am. And in the story, you need a careful investigation of the sequence of the story to unearth a certain detail. And the detail is this. This story, it sets up its tent in a crater. It mistakes the crater for a valley because it forgets the detonation. Okay? The detonation is the onset of the Iron Age. Now, once people have lived out the Iron Age for any length of time as a collective, the memory of a time before the Iron Age starts to vanish very quickly.
Correct.
One of the consequences of the Iron Age is the physical topography of the Middle East, the treeless expanse. I'm not talking about the Sahara. I'm talking about the Tigris, Euphrates, Israel, Lebanon, all kinds of places. And so many of them are treeless, and the Iron Age is why. So the excess that the capacity to cut introduced into the world is it borders on the unspeakable. Now, the detail here is that this is taking place in an area of the world that seemed, along with China and Middle America, one of only three places on Earth that came up with a combination of numeracy, literacy, agriculture, and the Iron Age almost all at the same time within some hundreds of years. It's really a staggering observation to begin to wonder, man, never mind why, but how did all that happen at one place? And one of the things clearly that took place is the advent that we take for granted now as a given of human industry. And the word we use in English is surplus. So I'm going to suggest to you that the advent of surplus was one of the great unrecognized calamities of really of the Western world, at least. And here's what I mean by that. There was a time in the polytheistic period where the grain, the head of grain waving in the wind, was God. Not from God, not a sign of God, not somehow inhabited by God, but as manifestly God as anything could possibly be. And if you think about the miracle of its reproductive capacity and everything, with no human hand, it's quite an extraordinary observation to entertain. And what happens is the understanding that this is God determines your agricultural practices. Obviously, right. It would. All the agriculture would be devotional. Yeah. It would be a form of prayer. But with the oncomingness of the Iron Age and a few other things that we don't have time to discuss right now, one of the consequences, I think inadvertent at the beginning, was the advent of surplus. And the consequence literally is more God than you need. And so instead of the grain God, you now have the grain that belongs to God, God's firstborn grain, and then you have all of the sacrificial acts and the firstborn parting with acts and all of these compensatory gestures that the various cultures try to craft to break even on this horrible miscalculation that there's such a thing as extra God, surplus God, God in the warehouse, God in the storehouse, God in the granary, God in the temple, God in the mosque, God in the church. You understand what I'm saying? God in the chapel. Instead of the world is God, and we're the ones who are in the chapel. We're the ones who are in the mosque and in the granary and so forth. So this calamity, we still have not seemed to have awoken to. And so in my small way, this book that I'm working on right now is an attempt to sound the little bell of the calamity, which is surplus anything. It doesn't sound that spectacular, but I promise you the consequences. It sounds
paramount. It sounds paramount. It really, I think it would probably cross above the heads of many who, including myself, I'll be honest. I told myself while you were saying this, once we finish our conversation, I'll have to think about this for the rest of the day. It is so paramount in its vision, but it's at the same time not at all how we were taught to look at this interesting engagement that we have here in the physical world. And in a very interesting way, I think, when you see it as such, as you rightly said, every action becomes a ritual. It's not really about every action is an action and then there is a ritual at the end of the day. Right, it's a exactly. Very different way to live. You know what, Stephen? I want to respect your time. I know you have another appointment, but at the same time, I have to say to my listeners that this is worthy of rewinding and listening to again, because some of the gold nuggets that you dropped along this path require introspection and reflection to really sink deep. And I would just wish and hope that you would allow me the time to continue the conversation another day.
Amen.
I mean, in a very, very, very grateful way, I am honored to have spent this time with you. I think what you teach us is, so it has always been valuable, but I think is the most needed at this time. So
you're very kind. You're kind of extreme in your kindness. So yeah. it's a lot to live up to.
I rarely come across the truth said in a way so articulate. And I say this to my audience because I encourage everyone to look at every single one of Stephen's books, but at the same time to look at his wisdom. By the way, if the orphan school is back, I'll be the first one to come and camp. I think I can listen to you for 4 months. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, too.
I'm really, really grateful for your wisdom. I'm grateful for your honesty.
Thank you for the opportunity and for the questions. And, you know, if we're spared, let's do it again soon.
I was going to say, I hope that life will give us the chance to get together soon. Thank you very much, Stephen.
Be well till then. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And for all of you listening, I truly recommend that you go back and listen to this conversation one more time. I think there is a beauty to the realization of the magnitude of the challenge that our world is about to embark on and the assumption of responsibility, as Stephen mentioned, that we have not only to engage, to do the actions that are corresponding to the magnitude of how we've come here, but at the same time to engage A little bit like the dying in the reality of living, in the reality that we are here today. And rather than focus on what could happen in 10 years or 15 years, focus on what can happen now. How do I live now? How do I engage now? How do I love now? And how do I act responsibly right now? This conversation might have felt a little grim to you, but I promise you it felt empowering, energizing, and joyful to both me and Stephen, because life has always been challenging. And life right now, as you're listening to me, as you're able to walk the streets, as you, most of you tell me, or walk in nature and have an hour to spare for this conversation, life is still amazing. So the point is, perhaps living is the answer to the challenges that we face. I cannot thank you enough. I really cannot thank you enough for the opportunity that you give me to just text people I admire and say, hey, you want to have an hour's conversation? Or just going to record it and get a few tens of thousands of people to listen to it with us. And they say yes, because you are there. And so I'm very, very grateful for the opportunity. Help me grow this initiative by telling others about it. Post about it on your social media or rate it 5 stars on your podcast player. Whichever way that you can spread this message, I think would hopefully make our world slightly better for those that it comes to. And perhaps one of the things that are most important in the times that we're in is to do what this podcast is all about, to look at your life and the speed through which we go through life and try to slow it down. You don't have to go farming, but perhaps you need to go a little bit slower in some of the engagements that you assume in life every day. So it doesn't matter how busy you are today. I encourage you to find a way to slow down. I love you all for listening, and I will see you next time.